Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start, as we always do, with the region's news. In Tokyo, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government enacted new security laws, which allows Japan to deploy its military overseas for collective self-defense. Thousands of Japanese citizens took to the streets in peaceful protests to express their opposition to the legislation. According to a recent Kyoto News poll, the majority of Japanese opposed the new laws. In Washington, D.C., Chinese President Xi Jinping arrived for a much-anticipated state visit to the United States. Xi kicked off the visit with a speech to the business community in Seattle before a series of meetings with President Obama. Most notably, the United States and China reached an agreement on cybersecurity, as China pledged to stop engaging in economic espionage. In New York, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi arrived for a multi-day visit to the US, coinciding with UN General Assembly meetings before heading to Silicon Valley to boost US-India commercial cooperation. Modi planned to meet with CEOs of Google, Facebook, and Apple to discuss expanding India's technological infrastructure. Meanwhile, South Korean President Park Geun-hye also plans to travel to New York to attend the UN meetings. In Kuala Lumpur, the FBI reportedly has opened an investigation into allegations of money laundering related to the embattled Malaysian state investment fund, 1MDB. The development fund is already tied to a massive payment into Prime Minister Najib Razak's personal bank accounts, which has compelled opponents to call for Najib's resignation. One of the controversial payments allegedly was transferred through a US bank, prompting the international investigation. And that's the news. In this episode, we take a broader look at the Asia-Pacific's economic and security architecture. Dr. Evan Medeiros, former Senior Director for Asia Affairs at the National Security Council and now at the Eurasia Group, provided his perspective on the region's institutional architecture earlier this week in an event at CSIS. This was Dr. Medeiros' first public speech since leaving the Obama administration.
I want to thank and applaud CSIS for continuing this focus on regional architecture. It's probably one of the most understudied aspects of geopolitical dynamics all over the world, but especially in the Asia Pacific, and it's one that I think benefits from more discussion and debate. It's not a sexy topic. As somebody that has participated in APEC and EAS and ARF meetings, it's pretty mind-numbing what it's like to actually sit there in the room. But as Murray and I were reflecting before, if you actually look at the arc of progress over time, especially in an institution like APEC, the progress curve is actually quite substantial. And on balance, these institutions can really make a difference. And I think Mike Froman did a nice job of summing up some of that earlier this morning. When I was here about a year ago, I talked about the Obama administration's approach to regional architecture, and I put forward four propositions, four sort of reasons why pursuing institutions in East Asia is important. And I just want to remind you of those because I think they remain as relevant today as they were a year ago. Why do we pursue institutions? Why do we use them in the Asia Pacific? Number one is to build and reinforce rules and norms. It's important to set a level playing field on both economic and security issues. Number two is lowering barriers to cooperation and creating incentives to work together on big problems. In essence, institutions pool ideas, they pool resources, they pool capabilities that allow numerous states to actually cooperate, to get past those sort of traditional collective action problems. Number three, institutions raise barriers to free riding and competition. When you have a seat at the table, it's harder to dodge the responsibilities of membership, and members are subject to the peer pressure of being a part of an institution. So I think that there are real important disincentives to just being a free rider. And then lastly, and something that's unique to the United States, for the U.S. to be involved in institutions makes U.S. power essentially more predictable and credible, because even though the U.S. may be at the top of, you know, sort of the food chain and international relations. Yet nonetheless, going back to U.S. grand strategy in the 1950s, the U.S. is willing to accept some restraints and constraints on its power to make it more credible and predictable, and also to resolve some of those credible those collective action problems. So that's the theory. That's the theory of why the U.S. pursues institutions, why the U.S. and other countries pursue institutions. The question is, does it work in practice? And that's what I'd like to talk a little bit about today. What is the delta between theory and practice when it comes to international institutions? And I have always believed that an important way to get at this question of the delta between theory and practice is to think about it in the context of the regional order. In other words, there's a regional architecture, which is the institutions that we create to achieve the economic and the security effects in the region that are beneficial to the United States and its partners in the region. But then there's the regional order. In other words, the sort of observed pattern of interactions among states in the region. It's sort of the environment in which the architecture lives. And it's the architecture that's theoretically the edifice that gets you to the order you want. And the reason I bring up order is because I think that the environment in which this institution building process is occurring is facing some real challenges in the Asia Pacific. I left the NSC in early June of this year and took off several months to just sort of, you know, decompress and take a rest. And when I jumped back into the events of the Asia Pacific a couple weeks ago, I was surprised at what I was seeing. Economically, politically, and on security terms, the risks and the uncertainty facing the region are growing. And I think all of those are going to be very challenging to being successful in the institution building project. And let me talk about those risks and uncertainties today. Economically, the region is flagging in a surprising sort of speed and scope. Start with China. Its economy is slowing, largely by design, well anticipated as an effort to implement third plenum reforms. But now, after the events of this summer, China's response to the collapse of the Shanghai Composite Index and its changing of the renminbi exchange rate mechanism, the government's response has been problematic, which has called into question the ability of the government in Beijing to manage this transition. The growing debates, especially in the U.S. financial community, about the ability of the leadership and to accomplish this very, very difficult task, and the growing questions of confidence about both Beijing's ability and willingness to pull this off, is a new and important dimension of the China economic transition story. Number two, Japan. Can Abe get Abenomics to work? Reflating the Japanese economy is proving exceptionally difficult. Generating domestic demand is not working, and external demand is not a solution, especially as growth in China slows. Look no further than what the S&P did last week. The S&P was the third major bond rating index that downgraded Japan's sovereign debt last week. As I said, it was the third major agency to do this. Japan's sovereign debt risk rating is now below that of Japan and South Korea. That's not a positive development. Look at Southeast Asia. Emerging economies in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, the Philippines, they're suffering badly from the trifecta of slowing global trade, the slowdown in growth from China, and the collapse in commodity prices. The growth forecasts for Brunei, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and the Philippines have all been revised downward by the major investment banks in the last two quarters. Currency prices are through the floor, and in some cases, currency prices are below the threshold of the 1997 financial crisis. The silver lining, I don't mean to be Debbie Downer, the silver lining is that Southeast Asia is not on the cusp of a financial crisis. These are economies that have built up quite substantial foreign currency reserves. They have, their debt is largely denominated in local currency. So I think the risks of a financial crisis, a repeat of 97, is unlikely. But nonetheless, their tools to respond to this flagging growth in the sort of environment of substantial economic headwinds is quite limited. Very few tools at their disposal. Because interest rates are so low for all of the emerging markets in Southeast Asia, monetary policy is not really an option. A looser monetary policy is not going to generate the domestic demand necessary. In terms of fiscal policy tools, again, relatively limited. It depends sort of country by country, but that's not going to be a solution to the problems in Southeast Asia. Ultimately, what is needed is structural reforms that promote consumer and domestic demand to replace the fact that there are the substantial drop in external demand. But as you know, the problem with structural reforms is fundamentally that's a political decision. Political leaders have to be willing to make very difficult, controversial decisions that involve taking on vested interest in economies. And look at Indonesia's experience, which is, to date, been very mixed. Which sort of leads me to the second big variable. So economically, major headwinds, unclear where the solutions are going to come from. Politically, in terms of the domestic politics of the region, the situation is not a lot better. I see a lot of uncertainty. First, several regional leaders face very complex domestic political dynamics that are hampering effective policymaking, hampering the kinds of choices that belonging to institutions like APEC would suggest, and that's especially so on economic issues. The countries that come to mind whose leaderships are facing particularly challenging domestic dynamics include Malaysia, Indonesia, and Thailand. Are these leaderships that have the, do they have the domestic political mandate necessary to bring about the structural reforms to generate growth? And for some of them, in particular, they're going to need substantial domestic political support to get into TPP. Brunei and Malaysia come to mind in that context. So several countries in the region face complex domestic political dynamics. Others just simply face domestic political uncertainty because of upcoming elections and transitions. As I'm sure many of you are aware, there is going to be a very major election in Burma this year that I think will have a decisive influence on the future economic and political trajectory of that country. In 2016, there'll be major presidential elections in the Philippines and in Taiwan. There will be major parliamentary elections in South Korea and Mongolia. And in January of next year, there'll be a major party congress in Vietnam. In 2017, there'll be a South Korean presidential election, and of course, the 19th party congress in China. So pretty soon, even in those countries where the leaders have a relative degree of domestic political mandate, with upcoming political transitions, these countries will enter into their own election cycles, which will further constrain the ability to make the kind of structural reforms I've talked about. And then on security issues, I think the challenges are fairly well known. There's both traditional and non-traditional ones. In terms of traditional security issues, the one at the top of the list is the South China Sea. I know those issues are very well known to the crowd here. But what has surprised me is the degree to which the scope and the pace of China's land reclamation, the fact that we're now debating the prospect of China having, China building possibly, three runways on its reclaimed features is worrisome. And the fact that China has reclaimed so much land has raised new and different questions, especially in the minds of American strategists and policymakers, about the nature of this problem. In other words, given the scope and the pace of Chinese land reclamation, the question is now, did China undertake this effort to improve its bargaining position? In other words, it's going to stop at some point and then decide to enter into negotiations, or more worrisome, and this is the new dimension, is China undertaking this effort as part of a strategy to create de facto effective sea control over the nine dash line. Either one of those choices, either one of those options or scenarios is not particularly comforting, and both hold the prospect of substantially destabilizing Southeast Asia. In terms of non-traditional issues, the two most obvious ones that come to mind is counterterrorism and the growing return of radicalized members of ISIL to Muslim countries in Southeast Asia. And the other major non-traditional challenge is natural disasters. Now, that's obvious and well known, but as somebody that lived through the experience of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines and the international community's response, it's difficult to overstate the degree of destruction that Super Typhoon Haiyan imposed on the southern Philippines. Luckily, the US, Japan, Australia, and other friends and partners in the region had the kind of relationship with the Philippines where we were all able to flow forces there relatively quickly to address that. The question is, will the international community, especially partners in Asia, be able to do the same thing if a similar or even a more destructive typhoon hits Southeast Asia? I don't know the answer to that, and that I find is very worrisome. So there are huge economic risks, there's political uncertainty, and the security challenges, while well known, there's no obvious sort of solution or pathway out there, and depending on which scenario you decide is more likely, could actually lead to greater downside risks in the future. So that presentation sounded a little bit more dire than when I wrote it. But nonetheless, I think when we talk about questions of regional architecture, we have to think about the regional order in which these conversations happen. And I think there are real challenges to the economic, political, and security environment in the Asia Pacific in 2015 that will affect our ability to turn theory into practice.
That was Evan Medeiros. Now on to our one to watch. Chief negotiators from the 12 parties to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPP, confirmed that they will meet from September 26th to the 29th in Atlanta in an effort to finalize the long-negotiated trade deal. The negotiators have a limited window to finalize the agreement, as trade ministers from each country will join for a full ministerial meeting on October 1st. The renewed emphasis from President Obama to conclude the deal in 2015 and the U.S. congressional passage of fast-track legislation earlier this year means that the pressure is on to get TPP done. Will we see a deal reached in principle over the next week? Certainly one to watch. That's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and also check out our island tracker and maritime specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.